Hello, sex fans, and welcome back. Today is Monday, November 2nd, 2009, and you are lucky enough to be listening to the podcast edition of Dr. Dick's Sex Advice with an Edge.
Pay no attention to that man behind the curtain.
Actually, you have to pay a little bit of attention to me because I'm your host, that savagely scintillating sexologist, Dr. Dick. And guess what? It's time for more of the erotic mind of that fantastic artist, illustrator, and erotic comic creator, Steve McIsaac. He's here to continue the conversation we began last week. You didn't miss that show, did you? Oh, listen, if you snooze, you lose. No, wait, that's not true. All my podcasts are archived on my site, so you can wander all over the last 3 years and pick up a slew of juicy interviews, a load of stimulating Q&A sessions, as well as other sexually enriching programming.
I don't think so.
But it's true. In fact, to find the first part of my discussion with Steve, simply use my site's search function. Type in podcast number 162 and presto. Hey, but don't forget to use the pound sign when you do the search. And be sure to check out Steve and his amazing artwork, especially his comic Shirtlifter, as well as his insightful blog on his site, stevemcisaac.com.
I think that this is your way of telling me something.
That is so true. Oh, my God. In fact, I want to tell you other stuff, too. Like today's podcast sponsor is, once again, So Hard. So Hard is what we in the business call a boner pill. But So Hard is not just any old Viagra knockoff. No siree. It's a pure, all-natural herbal formula that improves sexual health, combats erectile dysfunction, and increases the strength of your erection when aroused. Listen, I've tried So Hard, so I can testify to its effectiveness. Look for my review of So Hard on my new product review site, drdicksextoyreviews.com. Use the site's search function, type in So Hard, and you can read my comments and evaluation. And here's a tip. SoHardOnline.com is offering a special deal for a limited time. Buy 4 2 capsule packets and get the fifth packet free. Get your wood the natural way. Look for their handsome banner in the sidebar of my site. You'll be so glad you did.
I'm so ready.
Okay, then. Let's get on with the show. Welcome back, Steve, and thank you for joining us again. I'm so delighted that we could spend more time together because last week we only got to see a bit of an overview of your professional life, and I would very much like to find out more about you as a human and not just an artist. Can you give us a brief bio?
You're assuming I am human.
It's a huge assumption. I know
that's
that.
It's a huge assumption.
But you're a handsome and articulate Borg then, because...
Yeah, exactly. well, I'll give you the Borg part.
Anyway. All right, yay!
I am a 40-year-old Canadian living in Los Angeles after 4 years overseas in Japan. So I'm kind of a bit of a cultural mix, I guess. I have been drawing all my life, or 10 years, depending on how you count.
You'll because have to explain that.
Well, I gave it up.
Did you? Oh,
yeah.
No kidding.
I was basically born with a pen in my hand, and I drew and I drew and I drew, and I gave it up in my teens, or it petered out. I became much more interested in writing and actually in theater and radio and things that are sort of more performative and outgoing. I think I sort of realized that I was a pretty introspective kid, and cartooning, you spend a lot of time by yourself, and if I followed that tendency, I would be even more isolationist than I already am. So I pursued more social things. Partly because I wanted to come out of myself a little bit, and partly because I just convinced myself that I really sucked. I mean, I hit a plateau, and I just didn't seem to be getting any better.
Yeah.
So I went, partly because I just never did any formal training, really. It was all stuff I was figuring out on my own.
Right.
So I went to university and I got a degree in English literature and then a graduate degree in creative writing and English. Worked in radio for about 6 or 7 years, community radio, and then went back to school when I was 30, ostensibly to study design because I had sort of become interested in publication design, but quickly became seduced by the fine art program and had started reading comics again after about 5 or 6 years of not looking at them at all. So I was sort of on fire creatively, and suddenly I had some formal training, and so my skill set increased exponentially within like a 2 or 3 year period, and I just started submitting little comics to places, and they started getting published.
Did you actually fall out of love with comics themselves? I think I read that in some of the stuff that you sent me.
It wasn't so much falling out of love as much as I was... when I was in school, I had limited finances, and I had to sort of focus, you know, everything I had on, you know, just keeping my head above water, and that didn't really change in my 20s because I was working for a non-profit radio. I wasn't really being paid anything.
Mm-hmm.
So I just didn't have a lot of cash, and comics are really habit-forming. I wasn't going into the shops at all, so I never stopped reading them per se, but I was like rereading old ones that I had. And then suddenly I just kind of got obsessed again and sort of dipped my toes into the pool again, so to speak. And I really became interested on the other end of like more seriously, how do these things work and can I make comics and really interested in them more from a structural point of view and sort of stealing techniques or examining them in terms of technique and trying to understand the vocabulary and how they actually worked. So it was a little bit different than, you know, just being a passive consumer, which is probably how I would describe myself when I was younger.
Mm-hmm. So the stuff that you identify as autobiographical, were you designing those comics or making those comics, creating those comics as the thing was happening, or is this a look backwards?
I'd actually, it's really bizarre that I've become fairly autobiographical in a lot of my work because I was very resistant to the idea of doing autobiography at all. I mean, I don't think of myself as a particularly interesting person, and I don't think of my life as being particularly significant, so it seems like a little bit of hubris to sort of throw out yourself as sort of an avatar. Mm-hmm. At the same time, I think the work that I respond to the most tends to be the most personal. And if something does cleave close to my own experience, it seems like kind of stupid to dress it up and pretend that it didn't really happen to me. It's someone else that I'm talking about. So I guess I solve that by just, you know, I use fiction for one set of, for things where I'm making things up, and I use my own experience when I'm not.
Mm-hmm. I found it so fascinating in my conversation with Howard Cruz about, you know, over the span of his work, you know, 40 years of his work, that there were autobiographical incidents and, you know, that he weaved into his work, and some of them were pretty obvious, and other ones were more masked. He thought, you know, that this was a good outlet for, you know, discussing, you know, topics like, you know, gay liberation and coming out in the South and that sort of thing.
Right. Oh, definitely. I guess I see the content as being more important and the subject of what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. And whether or not I use fiction or autobiography to get there just depends on how closely I have specific experience in that.
Right.
So I think they're both valid. And certainly even the fiction that I do, there's elements of my life that get mixed in there, but it might be elements based on observation of other people.
Right.
Rather than like this happened to me and this is a Romano Clef about my life.
Right. So I've been having this running discussion with several of the other artists that I've been interviewing lately, and it concerns the distinction between artist and illustrator. And I'd love for you to weigh in on this, if you will. Are you an artist or an illustrator, or are you both? Ought there be a distinction?
I'm a cartoonist.
See, I knew you were going to say something like that.
I actually think I really suck as an illustrator. Being an illustrator is not my particular skill set. I'm not especially good at being given a script and telling, being told, you know, this is what you should do, and pull these elements out of this story. And we were thinking of an image like this. And when I'm trying to please other people, I get into sort of a headspace where I'm sort of worrying about doing what they want, and I'm not in the zone as I would be when I'm trusting my own instincts and doing an image that's just for me, or that's trying to illustrate a story that I'm coming up with. It's always a lot stronger. So I don't think of myself as an illustrator, and I would call myself an artist. And I do call myself an artist, and I do sometimes do work that sort of outside of doing comics specifically. But I think the word artist also includes writer to a certain extent.
So right, absolutely.
I don't think saying I'm an artist, you know, is being a disservice to me calling myself a writer, although I wouldn't call myself a writer at all, just because I very rarely do anything that's prose only outside of work. I teach writing at work, and I'm skilled at the structures that are involved, but it's not something I do. It's not something I do professionally or semi-professionally.
Right.
And I like cartoonists, even though my work isn't cartoony in the sense that you know, Peanuts is, for example. Mm-hmm. But there's an element of observation and caricature involved, and I'm trying to distill the essence of the world down to like as few lines as possible, and I'm trying to do the same thing with the writing.
Mm-hmm.
So both skills are sort of about stripping down reality and sort of trying to distill it into some kind of essence. Maybe
almost, yeah, it's like poetry as opposed to prose.
Or alchemy, you know, trying to change one thing into another.
Yeah.
So, cartoonist, I think, is a good compromise between those two things.
Right. You were at Comic-Con this past year?
July.
Right. And you hooked up with that Sean Z person?
Well, it depends on how you define hook up. <or host. laughs>
I won't tell.
No.
Sean's since it's just between you and I.
Yeah. And the world. No. No hooking up went on. But yes, I know Sean. I know Sean fairly well. And he's part of a group of LA cartoonists, and we kind of get together and hang out and try and support each other a little bit.
Right. Yeah, he's a sweetheart doll baby. I love him dearly, and I've never met him or his husband, but you know, or his dogs. But I hope to have that opportunity at some point. So, can you give us some impressions of the event?
Of Comic-Con?
Yeah.
It's not really my scene, but it's my scene. The thing about Comic-Con is that it's large enough that it includes a healthy sampling of various subsets, even though the event itself is really something I have no interest in. Like, I'm not really interested in video games.
Right.
I'm not really interested in television and movie previews, which is a really dominant part of the programming.
I was really surprised that was part of it. I mean, Sean said that when we had our discussion some weeks ago, and I just thought it was all about comics.
For years. I'm not really interested even that much in mainstream comic books.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't really follow Superman or Batman or any of those sorts of things. I do follow alternative and arts comics, and there's a healthy representation of publishers and artists there just because of the size of it. And I'm interested in you know, a subset of that, which is, you know, the gay comics culture, and there's a lot of queers who wind up at that show because they're geeks, and so there's a bit of, you know, there's a healthy audience just because of the size of the show. You know, 100 and 1,000 people a day, you know, 4% of that, you know, even looking at the statistics on the low end of it, you know, that's a lot of people
right,
potentially interested in your work.
Are you seeing any trends in terms of erotic comics? Are they growing in popularity?
I think we're on the third wave of erotic comics. Yeah, the first wave obviously would be Tom of Finland and his immediate successors or people who sort of were coming out at around the same time, like Etienne or the Hun, etc. And then I think in the 80s and 90s, a sort of a generation of people emerged who was kind of following that, but sort of carving out their own niche with maybe like a slicker, more commercially illustrative style. I'm thinking maybe of Glenn Hansen, for example, as someone coming out of that tradition, sort of merging sort of visceral kind of energy of the first wave with sort of a more commercial sensibility.
Right.
And then I think the third wave, I think I'm kind of part of the third wave where we've sort of internalized both of those sets of things and we're trying to tell our own stories outside of reacting to straight repression or even to immediately, we're not trying to copy what came before, we're just trying to find our own voices.
Right.
So I think I'd throw myself and Dave Davenport and Justin Hall and Ed Luce and I think all of us also, to a certain extent, we subvert the idea of what is erotic and include elements that aren't necessarily about getting off per se.
Mm-hmm.
There's a sexualized element to the work, but then you can read it on other levels as well, and we're interested in having it work on other levels.
Right. So the sexuality that you depict, or the eroticism that you depict in your comics, at least this is what I picked up, it was integrated into, sorry, it's not like, you know, let's illustrate, you know, someone having sex or, but it's matter of fact because it's involved with the characters.
Right. Sexuality exists on a continuum of human life and is not sort of isolated from things that surround it.
Mm-hmm. Unless you're shooting porn, and then that's a completely different story.
Right. Although, you know, even if you look at porn in the 70s, porn was much less afraid to look at context.
Oh, it's true.
Before, you know, so it's sort of almost like a retreat to those kinds of approach.
Right.
I guess the number one thing for me, even when we were doing Sticky, which is, I guess, the most explicitly erotic book that I did, our goal was to have sort of real human beings sort of interacting, and that's really what we wanted. We wanted sort of to show people having a connection and to slice of life porn is, I think, the moniker that Dale came up with to describe
it.
And it sort of is. You could sort of take two people and they put them together and then watching how they interact sort of as almost like an observer. And the sexuality that's in my own work, the stuff that I do by myself, it's there sometimes to provoke a sexual response and sometimes to provoke the opposite.
Right.
Like I spent a lot of time in the latest book 3, detailing a really bad sex scene in which, you know, one guy's they're really not connecting,
mm-hmm.
and there's a real almost an ignorance on the part of one guy who thinks they're having a great time, and he's unaware of the horror that his partner is experiencing. Just
mm-hmm.
like get me the fuck out of here.
Yeah. which is so authentically the gay experience for a good part of us.
Right, but it's not something that gets you off, right? I mean, nobody wants to like think about that when they're trying to achieve an orgasm. But I guess that I wanted to include it as part of sexual experience and as part of how sex does reveal character and how when you do meet someone that you do connect with, you know, when there is that connection, it can sort of override other concerns, you know, how subjective it can be. You know, you can think two people are the same or you can equally attracted physically to both, but you have a good time with one and you don't with the other. And why is that?
Right.
So I'm interested in character, I'm interested in context, and that can short-circuit desire somewhat, and I guess I just don't, it's not that I don't care so much, but it's not, I'm not that interested right now in pursuing straight up, you know, this will help you have an orgasm kind of books.
Yeah, right.
Sexuality, definitely, but...
Yeah. If someone took away all your pens... and pencils and paper and your computer drawing pad, would you be hard-pressed to continue?
It depends on when you ask me. right now, I would say, you know, take them away. Free me from this burden I've created for myself, you know. It can be frustrating sometimes.
Absolutely.
And more so simply because, you know, the amount of time and energy that I put into this is pretty much not monetarily compensated.
Yes.
So it's
there's a club for that, and I'm the president, but you
can
be the secretary.
Okay. Yeah. Anyway. And it's not like, I mean, it's not like I do it for money, obviously, but it can be.
But it's draining nonetheless.
It can be draining, and sometimes it can be frustrating, and you know, I'm just you periodically go through. Moments of, is it all worth it? And, you know, I'm sort of working my way out the back end of one of those, you know, where I think, you know, give it all up, you know, take up some other hobby. That
golf.
Isn't,
how about golf?
Yeah. but that being said, you know, I did give it up. I gave up drawing in my 20s, and, you know, I was probably the most depressed individual I've ever been in my life, and that I need some kind of creative outlet. It doesn't necessarily have to be comics. But I chose this as a medium because I thought I had something to say and to contribute, and I was not seeing a lot of work being done that was in the mode of what I wanted to do. I wasn't seeing the kind of work I wanted to see, and so that's like an opportunity.
Yeah.
I mean, if you can say that and say, okay, the kind of comics I want to do are not being done, that's, you know, you run with it because...
Yeah.
How many things can you say that about in life?
Well, I did the same thing, you know, when I was shooting porn with my company, Daddy O Productions. I shot the porn that I could not find, you know, in the marketplace. The stuff that interested me, and, you know, if it was applicable or interesting or arousing to anybody else, that was gravy. So, yeah, absolutely. Good. Do you think that... erotic artists like yourself are wired differently than us mere mortals?
No.
That's a trick question.
What exactly do you mean by wired?
I don't know. Do you have different sensibilities about the erotic world than, you know, most people?
Well, I do think there's a definite distinction between people who find drawings erotic and people who don't. Because I know people, you know, my husband's one of them, you know, he can look at a Tom Finland drawing and he can sort of appreciate it aesthetically, but it's not ever, art is never anything that he's found, you know, sexually arousing.
Right.
Whereas, you know, for me, you know, when I was first discovering erotic drawings, it definitely was. It was almost... more erotic than a photograph.
Yeah.
I responded much more because it seemed like more of a direct line into someone's imagination, and maybe because you can depict things that aren't actually real, or that can be hyper-real, and you can push beyond reality somewhat.
Yeah.
So more fantastical. So I think it's true that erotic artists are almost inevitably people who responded erotically to art. I mean, if they didn't have that charge, they wouldn't spend the time drawing.
Yeah.
I mean, drawing can be a very sexual thing, and it certainly, especially for me, it very much was in my teens and my 20s and early 30s. You know, you have a sexual charge from drawing something sexy. Mm-hmm.
Have you ever been on the receiving end of criticism for the work that you do? Has your art been denigrated by others, possibly other artists or comic creators, because of its content?
Not to my face. it depends on what you mean by denigrated. I mean, I've been criticized for, you know, drawing badly and stuff, but I don't think that's what you mean.
No, I don't. That's not what I mean.
I've been rejected from bookstores, and because they don't carry adult material.
Yeah.
They just don't carry porn, so they're not really willing to look at it outside of the context of that. Even though I don't really think of Shirtlifter in particular as being porn. So I've been sort of excluded from a few venues, and I think I'm labeled as an adult artist, even though there's other aspects to what I'm doing.
Sure.
But I don't know, denigrated, not to my knowledge. I don't think, if people are dismissing it or saying this is crap just because of it's porn, it's not something I'm aware of. If anything, I probably get more attention from certain elements of the press, because there's a sexual element to it, than I would otherwise.
Right.
I think
so. No one said to you, you know, you're such a talented man, and if only you were illustrating doggies and duckies instead of penises, you'd be a much happier guy, and the world would be a better place.
No, it would only be, if only you were drawing duckies and goosies, then we would carry your work. We'd carry your work, but we're a family bookstore,
right,
and we don't. So
I got it.
They have no criticisms of me as a human being, and quite to the contrary. In fact, I think when Sticky came out, it was universally sort of like acclaimed for being sex positive.
Yes, right.
I think there was a real cultural shift around depictions of pornography and adult material in the late 90s and early, you know, 2000s, and you know, it was possible to be a feminist and to like porn, which is a real shift from the earlier.
I'll say.
Earlier.
I'll say.
So, no, not that I'm aware of, but, okay. You know, people don't go out of their way to, you know, I've certainly seen people wince as they go by my table. So I sort of take that as an implied criticism.
Oh, maybe they didn't like the color scheme.
Maybe. Yes.
So what do you look for in the work of other erotic artists? Both literary and visual, if you'd like.
I'll stick to the visual,
okay.
I think. What do we look for? One, I think a personal and distinctive style, sort of a way of rendering the world that's unique in their own, even if you know, influenced by other people. Two, that they represent reality well. And by that I don't mean that it's photo illustrative,
right,
necessarily,
right.
But that, you know, I think erotic art is a slave to representation, I think, a bit more than other kinds of art, just because people have to recognize these as human beings, and the proportions can be exaggerated, they can be distorted, but they have to sort of be, they have to be right.
Right.
And so if you're looking at a drawing and mostly you're thinking legs don't go that way, it can kind of take away from the eroticism of it, if you're sort of double checking the anatomy or whatever. Number three, sort of non-pinup compositions.
Mm-hmm.
Like photography, one of the ways in which I think erotic photography has really gone off the rails is there's a preponderance of the pinup image where people are posing and strutting and they're trying to like mug for the camera. And so many drawings I see are sort of like a drawing version of the guy mugging for the camera, even though it's a drawing and not a guy mugging for the camera. So I like things that are not trying to just be photography in drawn form, but that are trying to, you know, even if they're based on photographs, like my work certainly is, trying to transform it in some way into its own sort of aesthetic, its own aesthetic thing. So guys with pouty lips, you know, making goo-goo eyes at the camera just doesn't, that's not something that interests me. But strong portraiture does, and off-kilter compositions and strong color sense, that always gets my attention. So those are things I look for. Great. I guess.
Would you be up for sharing something of your personal life? You do afford yourself a personal life, right? I wouldn't want our audience to think that your life is a super erotic athlete, all work and no play.
No, not at all. Sure, go ahead. What would you like to know?
Whatever you'd like to volunteer. You have a husband, I gather, from...
I have a husband. He's sitting across the table from me.
Is he making pouty things with his lips and Google eyes?
No, he's not making pouty lips with Google eyes at the camera. Although, he is a photographer.
Is that right?
Well, he likes to take pictures. He's wincing as they describe him as a photographer, but it's something he's become interested in the last couple of years. He's interested in comics and my comics work. He actually wrote a short story that I illustrated for a comics anthology. So we've been together about 4 years. Almost five now, four and a half. And we live in Long Beach, California. What else about me? I teach for a living. That's what my day job that keeps my head above water.
And does that balance you? I mean, you've mentioned that several times before in the past in this conversation. So it must do something for you other than just pay the bills, right?
It sort of does. I like teaching. I'm surprisingly good at it. I never thought I would be, but... it's good, it's social, and it keeps me from disappearing into my own head all the time. And it's very language-based, so it's very, very left brain, so I can disappear into the right brain when I'm not working on those things. So it does provide a nice balance. Sometimes it provides too much of a balance because it overwhelms me. Right now I'm very, very busy with work, so I don't have as much time to draw as I would like.
What does the future hold for your work?
What does it hold? I am finishing up the next chapter of Unpacking, which will be published in the fourth issue of Shirtlifter, which will come out next year, God willing and Satan willing and all of those other deities willing. I'm about a third of the way through it, just a bit over one third, serializing it online, two tiers per week at Modern Tales. So it's kind of a rough draft, but I need a deadline or I would just not get anything done.
Right.
So that forces me to draw even when I'm sick or tired or whatever. So I've been doing that for a while. I just finished a short story that came out in a book of erotica called I Like It Like That. About my first threesome. It's called Amanuensis, and it just came out from Arsenal Pulp Press. I'm working on a couple of other short little pieces that I'm considering submitting to a few different anthologies. And Unpacking is really sort of a monster, so it's taking up most of my time and energy. I do sort of some art shows and comic book shows throughout the year, but I'm not going to be doing anything else until it's done. So hopefully it will be out in May or June next year. At the earliest, maybe September or October at the latest. Just depends on how much work I get done this fall and spring.
Well, get back to work, damn it.
Yes, I will.
So before we conclude, could you give us your website address again and walk us around a bit? And can we buy your work there?
Sure. Website address is www.stevemacisaac.com, S-T-E-V-E-M-A-C-I-S-A-A-C, two A's, one S. Everybody gets that wrong. You can see samples of my work, previews of the first three issues of Shirtlifter, and yes, you can buy them on the website, or there's also links that will take you to the Amazon.com page where people can pick that up if they would prefer to get it through our biggest online book giant instead. There's also cards and prints that you can't buy through Amazon there, but you can get them through me, and I'm probably having a print sale in the next 2 weeks, actually, so maybe by the time this airs, there'll be a link to a print sale just in time for Christmas.
Yay.
My economic stimulus package.
Excellent. Well, thank you, my friend, for so much of your precious time. It's really been enlightening, and you are such a thought-provoking kind of guy. I really love your stuff, and I'm grateful that you came and spoke with us. So until we meet again, either in person or chat again, we'll be seeing each other in cyberspace.
Thank you very much. It was my pleasure being here.
Take care, Steve. Be well.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Hey, fantastic show, huh? Well, that's it for today, sex fans. I'm so glad you could join me. Tune in next week for more sex advice with an edge with your host, me, Dr. Dick.
Come on! Quit stalling!
Oh my God, you're just so impatient. Again, this week's podcast sponsor is So Hard. I know what you're thinking. With so many herbal supplements on the market that boast fast-acting results, it's hard to know which erection-enhancing formula to choose, or if one shouldn't just avoid them altogether. I always tell my clients to beware of the bogus claims and dangerously adulterated products that abound in the marketplace. So Hard is different. It's made of 100% herbal extracts. It's as effective as any medically prescribed drugs I've ever tried, but it's much kinder to my system. There were no headaches, unsightly flushes, upset stomach, rise in blood pressure, or altered vision.
That's silly.
No, it's not. In my years-long search for the holy grail of herbal erection enhancers, I have found only one product that consistently delivers on the promises it makes, without any of the nasty side effects. So Hard improves genital blood circulation, which assists in achieving and sustaining a strong erection. As you know, every human body is unique, and each of us metabolizes what we consume in a slightly different way, so keep that in mind when you use So Hard. And just so that we're clear, So Hard is not miraculous. It will not override an unhealthy lifestyle, but it can positively affect our sexual response cycle, making us more easily aroused, as well as more energetic lovers. So look for the So Hard banner in the sidebar of my site.
That feels really powerful.
See, I told you. And look for all of Dr. Dick's podcasts on iTunes. You'll find me in the podcast section under Health, subcategory Sexuality, or just search for Dr. Dick's Sex Advice. Don't forget to subscribe and leave a comment when you do. Until next week, remember, sex is good. And good sex? Why, that's even better. Over and out.